to her feet. Another murmur ran through the crowd. She had not been told to rise. Joseph saw her eyes harden as they fixed on Covenant.
"We should talk where it is less likely that we die of cold," said Bishop Zelita, "most honoured Lord Inquisitor."
Joseph smiled in spite of himself.
"Abbot!"
Iacto was hugging warmth back into himself in front of a fire in his chambers. He turned from the flames as Sister Claudia hurried over to him.
"What?"
he asked.
"Fire!" she said, handing him a spool of parchment. "The Western Pilgrim Drift is burning. The Archdeacon has ordered a cohort of the guard out, and those pilgrims that can reach the Gate of Bells in the next hour are being given shelter."
"What?"
"Your Holiness should—"
"Fool,"
growled Iacto, crushing the parchment in his hand. It was probably too late now.
"His order says that he wanted to be sure that the bishop knew he was taking every step to safeguard the monastery and aid the weak of the blessed emperor's flock."
"Oh, I am sure," he spat.
"I wonder if he didn't start the damn fires himself."
He closed his eyes and shook himself. Behind him, the signal set that was his honour and privilege to use as head of his order clattered out fresh a ribbon of parchment. He barely noticed. It was probably some update on the number of souls saved from the fires that Archdeacon Saul would soon be able to point to as a sign of his piety, beneficence, and foresight. Saul's move made sense. With so much unrest, the Shrine Guard were the foundation of stability. It was as good a position for Saul as Iacto had seen. How, in the name of all that was holy, had he not anticipated such a simple play? But Saul had not seen what Loa had shown Iacto in the old cistern. Things were not just bad in the drifts, they were something else. Maybe this played into his hands. If it went badly in the drifts, if the Shrine Guard caused a riot now, then Saul would... Iacto blinked. His head was pounding again, but he had made a decision.
"Go and try to stop the guards going into the drift," he said.
"What?" asked Claudia. "How?"
"Any way you can. Signal Loa. Remind her that I made her, and I can cast her down. Get her to stop it any way she can."
Claudia turned to leave, and then paused and turned back. Iacto was waiting for the pain to fade from his head.
"Yes,"
he snapped.
"Why do you want to stop it? If sending in the Shrine Guards will cause a riot, why stop it? It will ruin him."
"Because I have a feeling it might cause more than a riot, and who wants to rule over ashes?"
Loa caught up with the Shrine Guard cohort as it reached the Gate of Bells. Boots rang on the iron slab floor as they marched in two lines towards the open doors that led out into the noon dark. It was barely past midday, but night filled the space outside. The season of night began at the peal of midnight's bell, but the last remnant of daylight was a smudge beyond the snow clouds. The marching cohort all had round steel shields with iron truncheons and shot pistols hanging at their waists. Thick fur ringed the wrists and collars of their jackets. One in every five held burning baskets of flame on long poles. Pipes led from the poles to canisters of gas on their backs. They could be used to send a breath of flame out 10 paces, but their chief use was simpler. Light. A steady stream of pilgrims was coming through the gate the other way, rag-swathed, heads bowed and dusted in snow. Some clutched bundles that must have been their whole worlds. They moved aside for their passing Shrine Guards, but kept moving forward into the light and shelter beyond the gate. Some of them looked around as Loa jogged up to the head of the column, but looked away quickly when she glanced back.
"What are you doing here, Loa?"
growled Gorda as she reached the front of the marching column.
"This is not your duty. You need to wait," she said.
Gorda turned her masked face to glance at Loa, but did not stop moving towards the open door. Silent bronze bells hung in the recessed arch inside the door.
"Wait! Why? Do you have new orders? The bishop has not been consulted about this. said Loa, still breathing hard from the run from the other side of the complex.
"The Archdeacon has given the writ. We go 500 paces out, and when the sacred hour of mercy is past, we make sure that the less lucky stay out there. And unless you have a fresh message from his hand, you need to get out of the way, or get in line,"
snarled Gorda.
"This is a bad idea, Gorda,"
she shouted above the wind.
"It's an order,"
Gorda shouted back.
"I made oaths, and you don't get to drop that when you don't like where they take you. You never did understand that. Now piss off and let me do my duty."
They were at the threshold of the Gate of Bells. The torchlight streamed above them, and she saw fur-swathed members of the Order of the Key waiting, ready to haul the 4-meter-high door shut. The wind hit her as she kept pace with Gorda. The cold sliced through the joints in her armour, and the leather and fabric beneath. The snow was falling heavily now, carpeting the paved road as it sloped down from the door. The lean-tos and piled shacks of the drift rose up beside them, stacked against the stone of the monastery walls like the remains of scrap and rock-crete beasts who had climbed one atop the other and then collapsed from exhaustion. More pilgrims were staggering up the road. In the distance, Loa could see a wide smudge of fire glow beyond the blizzard. She paused, biting her lip, then cursed to herself and hurried after Gorda as the shrine guards marched down the road. Loa glanced back up the road and could just see the torches burning beside the Gate of Bells. The shacks around them were silent and dark, without a sliver of light or a thread of smoke from a fire burning on a cold night. The glow of the greater blaze was just visible above the roofline, but she could smell it, thick and heavy, the smell of burning plastic and wood barely diluted by the cold air. The wind was pouring down the snow-filled road, throwing clumps of snow at them. Loa paused for a step, looking up and around. Then she caught up with Gorda and caught the other senior's arm.
"You came out here in case the door shutting caused trouble, but where are the pilgrims? This place looks deserted. There should still be people trying to get to the doors or get away from the fire."
Gorda shrugged free of Loa's hand, but signalled to stop the column and looked around. The sound of the wind filled the silence, and the snow the dark.
"Where are they?"
asked Loa again. She was not just speaking now because Iacto had sent her. She felt as though a shadow had slid into her skin with the cold. A spill of fabric stirred in the slit opening, cut into a shack wall. 2 stories up, a door swung on its hinges as the wind breathed snow into the space within.
"Where is anyone?"
Gorda turned as though seeing the pilgrim drift for only the first time. Nothing moved except at the wind's touch. Loa glanced back at the torchlight and the door. A few pilgrims were still struggling up the slope, but the flow was slackening. She should have stopped some of them and asked what was happening in the drift. She wondered suddenly if it was the fire they had been running from. She was suddenly wishing that she had not agreed to Iacto's offer to help her become a senior in the Shrine Guard. She wished that she had not listened to that part of her that wanted to be the one giving orders, not receive them. It had been a false assent, and she had just swapped one set of obligations for another.
"There was supposed to be a pestilence," said Gorda, as though answering Loa's thoughts. "Then where are the sick?"
said Loa.
"Thousands of souls in this drift, and only that many have gone through the gate. It's the eve of the season of night. They should be fighting to get inside the walls."
Gorda did not answer, but kept looking at the faces of the silent buildings.
"Divide by lines," shouted Loa to the cohort waiting behind them. "Shields up."
Gorda did not countermand the order, and the blocks of men and women split into ranks, facing out to the edges of the street, shields touching, iron staves ready. The guards with the fire poles took up positions a step behind the line.
"What's that?"
asked Gorda, pointing to the far left side of the street at a wooden and rusted metal flight of stairs. A walkway of planks ran along the flaking building. Some fabric had been attached to the post at the top of the steps, and was whipping and snapping as the wind caught it. Loa stared at it. There was something wrong about it, but she could not tell what.
"Go and look,"
said Gorda to one of the guards at the end of the line. The man moved up the steps, slinging his baton but still holding his shield.
Loa looked to the other side of the street, trying to shake the feeling rattling her skin as the cold dug deeper. She stopped, her eyes fixed on an alley opening between two buildings. There was something moving beyond the snow swirl, something coming closer.
"We need to get back to the gate,"
she said, but her voice was dry and low. The guard arrived at the top of the steps and reached out for the flapping piece of fabric. Loa's hand found the scatter pistol at her waist. The shape in the alley mouth was a blot of color, growing brighter as the light from the flame poles touched it. Red. It was someone in red. The guard on the stairs had hold of the piece of fabric and tugged it out so that the wind caught it. The figure in the alley stepped closer. It was hunched and shuffling as though old or carrying something under its red rags.
"Stay where you are," called Loa.
Gorda's head jerked around. Loa's gun rose. The wind caught the fabric in the guard's hand and snapped it out like a flag. It was not cloth, though. It was wet and slick and had empty holes for eyes and mouth. The red figure stopped in the alley mouth. The guard at the top of the steps screamed and pitched back. And the red figure was straightening up, red cloth sliding from it like a shedding skin. Loa's shot pistol roared. A cloud of lead hit the thing that was still unfolding from under its red robe, and in the gun's flash, Loa saw something that looked starved and withered, its flesh streaked with blood and hung with hooks. But its face. Its face was old and wrinkled, and its mouth was sewn shut. The shot punched it backwards, and it was falling, limbs tangling in red rags. A shout echoed out behind Loa. She twisted. Figures were standing on the roofs and in the mouths of every alley and door. Red rags, streaked with crude dyes, flapped in the wind. Metal masks hid some of their faces. Others were bare to the freezing air, wrapped in barbed wire and streaked with blood. They were silent for a second, unmoving in the after-echo of Loa's gunshot. The lines of shrine guard seemed frozen, the whole scene a picked image through which snow fell. Then the figure that Loa had shot levered itself off the ground. Loa aimed and fired. A new hole tore into it. The figures in red shouted and leapt forwards. Some of the shrine guards had drawn their pistols. Scattered shots rang out. The thing in front of Loa jerked forwards, famine-thin limbs juddering. A heat haze blur surrounded it. Loa broke the breech of her shot pistol. She could smell burning hair and incense. The shells dropped into the breech, and she snapped it closed as she raised it to fire. The thing gripped her as the shot punched into its gut. It rocked in place, but did not let go. Someone had stitched the tips of broken knives onto its fingers. She could feel them digging into her armor. Loa felt her thoughts fray. She was only dimly aware of the sounds of fighting all around her. The thing held her up to its face. Wisps of hair blew around it. It looked at her. Its pupils were black slits in amber. It opened its mouth, ripping flesh and stitches. The smell of sweetness and burning poured out with its breath. Cracks of flame were spreading across its skin.
"Help me," it gasped. He said it was truth."
And then it came apart in a wave of fire and lightning. Joseph felt the warmth fold around him as they stepped out of the biting cold into a stone-lined passage that led off the landing platforms. Candles burned in thousands of niches cut in the wall. Covenant was a pace in front of him, walking beside the bent-backed bishop. The high priest was saying something about pilgrims and food supplies. Joseph glanced up, rubbing his hands together. More candles sat in silver candelabras hanging from the ceiling. The metal was so tarnished it was almost black. The gilded halos of painted saints and warrior angels gleamed.
The air smelled of tallow smoke and dust. For a second, and for a reason he was not sure he could put into words, he felt more peaceful than he had in months.
"Why are you smiling?" snapped Epicles from just behind him.
"How can you tell?"
growled Joseph, without turning to look at the astropath.
"Unless you've been lying all this time, you are blind."
He paused.
"No. In fact, that is perfectly likely."
"I can't see you smile, you idiot, but you are whistling again, and I can only imagine you do it with a grin on your face."
Joseph's step slowed.
"I am not whistling," he said.
"Yes, you are. Just because I'm blind does not mean I can't hear. There, you have started again now."
He was about to look behind him when the candle flames winked out. The key keepers on the Gate of Bells were shepherding the last pilgrims over the threshold when there was a flash out in the night. They flinched back, eyes clamped shut. They could see shapes in the images glowing on their retinas, shapes like wings and claws. One retched, half falling, hands slamming into the worn stone of the passage floor. The other key keepers were dragging and pushing the heavy door shut, shouting at each other. A kilometre away, green fire reached up into the snow-blurred night. A second later, they heard another explosion scream into being. The sound reached across the distance instantly. It shook in their skulls, babbling, shrieking, the clamour going on, but it felt distant now, as though they were seeing and hearing through a hard sheet of crystal. Above them, the bells, silent for thousands of years, shivered. Another of the keykeepers vomited. The rest stood, staring for a moment as the fires washed out and new buildings began to burn, pinned in place as the light of flames painted nauseating colours amongst the falling snow. Then they saw the first of the ragged figures running up the road towards the doors. Some were burning, tatters trailing smoke as they ran. Knives, cleavers, and hooks gleamed in their hands. The keykeepers moved then, screaming at each other as they turned the handles to haul the doors shut. Up the road the tide came, silent, bare feet leaving bloody prints in the snow. Their last view before the doors closed was of metal masks nailed over faces, fingers and tatters of skin hanging from them like the jewels of a great king. Then the doors closed, and the iron bars fell across them, and above them the bells tolled. Darkness swallowed them instantly. Joseph had unslung his hammer from his back before he had taken a second breath. Someone screamed.
"God, Emperor, have mercy!
We repent!
Mercy!"
"Silence!"
roared Joseph. The targeting lens on Covenant's shoulder cannon lit as it spun.
"Negative four targets," called Coleg, "but the temperature has dropped."
And then the candles lit again. The flames burned bright and white, spearing upwards, growing as they burned like artillery flares. The tallow was hissing as it melted and flowed. Joseph snarled and clamped his eyes shut against the light.
"No, no, no!"
The shout tore the air. Joseph opened his eyes, turning. Epicles was curled on the floor. Blood flowed down his face and between the fingers of his hands clamped to his ears. Joseph was beside him. Behind him he could hear the sound of running feet as some of the bishop's entourage fled.
"Calm,"
said Joseph, as he lifted the astropath to the side of the passage. Epicles was scrabbling at Joseph's arms, like a child in the grip of a nightmare.
"We are here! We are here!"
The paint and plaster on the ceiling was charring. Smoke was billowing up the walls from the blazing candles. Running steps came up the corridor, guns rising to greet whoever was coming.
"Bishop Zelita!"
A loud, clear voice echoed down the corridor. Joseph looked up from Epicles's bloody face. A sister of battle in the armour of the Order of the Argent Shroud was striding towards them. The hair framing her dark face was ash grey. A sword was sheathed across her back, a bolter in her hands. Bishop Zelita looked around. Coleg's pistol had snapped up, finger tight on the trigger.
"Do not fire!"
shouted the bishop.
The authority in that voice was strong enough that, if it had been anyone other than Coleg, he might have flinched. The specialist's aim did not waver.
Lord,
he said.
Hold fire, said Covenant.
He had not drawn his sword, but his psi cannon was panning back and forth, hunting for threats.
It is too bright, gasped Epicles. Too dark. The ferryman and the coin bearers are here. Too bright beneath the earth, too dark to see. Bishop Zelita, said the sister of battle, not pausing in her stride.
One of her attendants was trying to pull her away. She shrugged the man off.
There has been an incident in the Western Pilgrim Drift.
When?
Snapped Zelita. Moments ago. They are running to bring you word, but panic is boiling up from the Western Cloisters. They are saying that no one lives in the Western Drift, that the fires were breathed by witches, and that creatures of the dark beat against the doors.
The Shrine Guard?
100 had already gone out to regulate the pilgrims permitted within the walls. They are gone.
Gone? Why were they there in the first place?
The High Sentinel.
Western Pilgrim Drift,
said Orsino, cutting across the Sister of Battle's words as she came to stand next to Covenant.
That is the area 7 kilometers west, according to the data. If we loft the gunships now, we can have 3 units there in minutes.
Do it,
said Covenant. He looked at Joseph, who was kneeling beside the shivering Epicles.
Go with them.
Joseph started to rise. One of Orsino's arbitrators bent over Epicles. Covenant's gaze moved to the Sister of Battle.
You as well, Sister Agata.
She looked surprised at his use of her name. Then she bowed her head, though there was reluctance to the gesture, thought Joseph.
You are the Inquisitor,
she said, as though half in answer and half in question.
I am,
said Covenant, turning to look at the bishop and the others still clustered together as the flaring candles finally dimmed.
I am Covenant, and in the name of the holy orders of the God Emperor of Mankind, I place this monastery and all those dwelling here under my command and will.
Chapter 8.
What in the eyes of sacred terror is that? Asked Baal.
Viola glanced around from the enhanced view of Dominicus Prime's northern hemisphere. The image filled the space above the Dionysius command dais, turning the view beyond the ports into a magnified sheet of detail laced with Auspex data. The ship was in low orbit, sunk as deep as it could go into the gravity well and holding station above the Monastery of the Last Candle. It was there to provide oversight, signals, and support if needed. That had been the intention, up until a few minutes before.
It's a storm, said Viola, her eyes flicking over data cascading across 3 sets of screens.
Don't storms that size come from somewhere? Asked Baal.
Yes, she said, not moving her eyes, trying to soak in information and form a conclusion, any type of conclusion about what was happening. The storm had sprung up as the dropship had descended, spreading across the planet's north like ink poured into a bowl of water. It had grown fast, in contradiction to any atmospheric models or data.
Mistress Viola, we cannot get signal penetration through the storm layer. Multi-spectrum interference. Wind speeds rising.
So how does something like this, began Baal,
but she cut the life ward's question off before he could finish.
It is not natural.
She turned and looked at Baal and wondered again why she had not dismissed him when she had come up into the command deck. There were 20 household troops within shouting distance, and a personal life ward at her elbow was largely superfluous. That, and he kept asking questions.
There is no reason for it to be there. It should not be there. It should not be that big, or have formed so fast.
Mistress von Castellan, the secondary astropath is signaling that there is a major etheric disturbance.
Multiple storm cells forming.
Communication links to Crow Complex lost. Signal relay to Monastery of Beneficence breaking down. Mistress, we have lost all direct communication to the surface.
Suddenly, the bridge seemed to quiet. On the image filling the space above the command throne, the swirl of storm cloud sat across the dark face of Dominicus Prime. Clusters of signal data flickered from amber to red.
The astropaths!
The secondary astropath has fallen into a delirium, Mistress Viola, answered the signals officer before she even finished the question. Telepathic connection via astropath Epicles is not possible.
Thank you for clarifying that, she snapped.
My apologies, mistress, called the officer, and she could see the signals officer's face stiffen. She took a breath. The stims and cognition enhancers were playing a merry dance with her nerves. She needed rest. She needed silence. And that was exactly what the present would not allow her.
Navigators report etheric disruption is rising, called another communication officer, a vox tube pressed to her ear. Sensors are failing, mistress. Interference flooding Orspex filters.
She needed to focus. She needed to process the data of what was happening and select a strategy. She needed to start making decisions.
Mistress Viola, we are blind.
Blind. She thought of Cleander in the Medicaid chamber, eyes closed, surrounded by the thump and hiss of machines. She had only had the time to see him once since they had entered the system. He had looked thin, weak, not like her brother at all. Nerve damage and cranial bleeding, ISO had said. Try this. She looked around, shivering and blinking, wondering how long. Just a second or so, said Baal, holding out a small tarnished silver flask. You only phased out for a second. No one noticed. Around them, the din of the bridge still surged and growled. Viola stared at him and then the flask. Niren, from my home, distilled from parchment mulch, would you believe? She took the flask and took a swig. Fire spread through her. She coughed the word.
It's vile.
Her eyes were watering. Baal grinned as he took back the flask. But good for taking the edge off a stim burn when it's building up. Seen it before more than a few times. Viola shook herself. The jolt of spirits had helped. The shadow of a grin was still on Baal's face as he tucked the flask into his belt beside a holstered pistol.
You were wrong,
she said coldly, looking back to the clusters of officers, servitors, and crew.
They all noticed. On a ship, everyone notices everything. They have all seen me overload before, so don't make it seem like I can't cope now. Understand?
Yes, mistress, he said crisply, his face now a stiff mask.
All defences to full alert. Armsmen to the command and engine spaces. If we are blind, then let's not be stupid, too.
The replies echoed up, but she hardly heard them. Her eyes were back on one of the clouds blanketing the planet's arc beyond the viewport. As she watched, a kilometer-wide patch of cloud strobed with lightning.
Target vessel 90% sensor blind, said the tech priest, wired into the gunship's systems.
90%,
said Ninkara, not looking up from checking the void suit's fit and seals. The gunship was rattling and bucking as they boosted through the last layers of Dominicus Prime's atmosphere. She preferred more preparation for a task like this, a lot more preparation.
There is a lot in that 10% that could turn us into vapor as soon as we break atmosphere.
True, said the tech priest, stirring in its system cradle. It was a bloated, cable-wrapped thing with data sockets for eyes, but for some reason a perfectly formed mouth of white teeth.
The rogue trader vessel designated the Dionysia does possess armament capable of destroying us, but its power output suggests that it is focusing on the planet and trying to make a signal connection with the surface.
How long until they might have a clear view of us?
6:03.
Are our countermeasures functioning?
To the best of my awareness, our etheric shielding has maintained the function of this craft's sensor countermeasure systems.
Ninkara did not reply. The gunship was not conventional, even for the myriad forms of craft that came from the forges of the Adeptus Mechanicus. Hunch-winged and angular, it was heavily armed and studded with exotic systems countermeasures. Its proportions seemed subtly wrong to her, as though its angles were intended to confuse, and its proportions were intended for beings larger than a normal human. For covert infiltration and warfare, though, it was a tool beyond compare. She just hoped that it proved a match for whatever the rogue trader ship had. She lowered the void helmet over her head and heard it hiss as it pressurized. Her two cyberhawks were comatose and stowed in the vacuum cylinders with the rest of her equipment. Her preparations, just like the plan she was following, had been formed of necessity in the time it took the gunship to reach the edge of the planet's atmosphere. She had considered other options, other ways of approaching the Dionysia, and longer timelines of infiltration, but the atmospheric and etheric disturbance had made up her mind to hit the rogue trader ship without pausing.
"We have a clear visual feed if you desire direct observation of our course," said the tech priest.
"Show me," nodded Ninkara. A second later, a picked panel on the other side of the compartment lit with multicolored static. The blur of colors resolved into an image of night streaked by distant whirls of light from where the warp storms were curdling the starlight. Set against it was the dagger form of a ship, its flanks grey stone and black iron, its prow a golden barb. It grew even as she looked at it, the serrations on its spine becoming towers and basilica. It was small compared to the great warships of the Imperial Navy, or the bulk of a macro-hauler, but it was still a city cast into the vacuum in the skin of a cathedral.
"What about an ingress point?" she asked.
"I have located a suitable ingress point that requires no direct hull breach and affords minimal probability of detection."
Blue lines carved off a section of the image, and it grew to fill the screen. It showed an area of the ship's hull where a deep gouge had bored through stone and armor to leave a black puncture wound.
"Battle damage," said the tech priest. "Full outer skin breach, 40.24 meters at its widest point."
"Recent?" she asked.
"Yes, and they have been unable to effect repairs, so it is probable that they have sealed internal bulkheads around the internal damage."
"And the probability that they have filled the area with murder servitors and gun platforms?"
"Unknown. But that will be evident in 100 seconds. Brace for ingress."
Ninkara felt the mag harness grip the back of her void suit and yank her against the compartment wall. The image of the picked screen blinked to what must have been a true eye view. The side of the Dionysia loomed, the pinprick lights of viewports a false field of stars. She could see the needle points of sensor towers and the light reflected from the planet beneath catching on its prow.
"Passing void shield envelope," said the engine seer.
The gunship buzzed as exotic energies played over its hull.
"They have active shields," she breathed.
"And an active and alert defense turret system that has almost identified us as a target 20 times in the last 10 seconds.
"Is that supposed to be comforting?"
"I do not know what you mean. The statement was accurate. Comfort is not a value that I can analyze."
His stream of speech paused, and he turned his head as though looking out through the hull with eyes that he no longer had.
"We are about to enter the hull breach."
The screen view of the void outside went black. The gunship juddered as vector thrusters fired, cutting its speed and nudging it forward through the cavern of twisted girders and torn decks.
"Setting down," said the engine seer. "No indication of detection."
The fuselage rocked and then shook as landing feet locked to the deck. Ninkara stood, harness snapping free. She floated for a second, and then activated the maglocks in her boots, and her feet clamped to the floor.
"Opening external hatch," said the engine seer.
The atmosphere inside the cabin hissed into the dark as the rear hatch dropped.
"Once you are out of this craft, I will not be able to communicate with you," said the engine seer as she moved towards the darkness beyond the open hatch.
She looked back at the bloated figure in its nest of cables.
"Any signals, even short range, risk detection. I will shut down the craft and its spirit, and I shall enter a dormant state until you return."
"Of course," she said, and stepped down the ramp, tugging her floating vacuum cylinder.
"The products of good fortune attend you in your undertaking," said the tech priest.
She paused and looked back again. The gunship was already darkening, system lights winking out one after another. She thought of saying thank you, but in the end, she just nodded and stepped onto the Dionysia.
"That's it."
The voice came from the glowing light in front of his eyes. It was somehow both melodic and cold, like a note struck on a scalpel.
"That's it, my Lord Duke. You can wake up now."
Cleander tried to say something, but the words clogged.
"I said wake, Your Grace, not speak. It will take a little longer for the anesthetics to wear off. They are nerve-specific, and your jaw and tongue are low down on the list."
The light became sharper. He saw the outline of a head and shoulders bending over him. Something silver glittered as a hand withdrew from beside his neck. More details. Crystal-lensed eye implants beneath a bald scalp, cyan and crimson plastic robes, needle-tipped fingers. A chromed servo skull buzzed above them, probe and fine manipulator-tipped tentacles hanging beneath it. It dipped closer, gripped his left eyelid with a tiny claw, pulled it wide, and flicked a beam of light across his pupil. He tried to turn his head away, but nothing moved. The servitor let go and floated next to the bald figure, and burbled something that might have been words if those words had been spoken by a clockwork toy. Iaso. That was the bald figure's name. Medicae Primus Iaso. She was his chief and very expensive Medicae attendant on the Dionysia, and this small, bright space with its chemical smell and the low beep and murmur of subtle machines must be one of the Medicae chambers in the ship's command levels. He was here because...
"I had instructions from the Lady Viola to ensure that she was present when you regained consciousness."
Iaso looked at him. Her carbuncle eye lenses were like two black pearls, reflecting back the image of him lying on a white pallet hung from the ceiling by an articulated piston arm. White cloth and red plastic bindings covered his body.
"I thought, though, under the circumstances, that it might be better if we talked first. You may have to lie to your sister about it, but Your Grace is well practiced at that."
Some of the numbness was leaving his body. He could feel a series of dull aches creeping through his muscles. He tried his jaw and tongue again, and found they moved, though they felt heavy.
"What?"
he began, and gagged on the dryness of his mouth. Iaso flicked a hand, and the servo skull buzzed forward and squirted water between his teeth. It tasted metallic.
"What? What happened?" he managed. "A simple question with a complex answer. The simple part is that you suffered an overload to parts of your nervous system and a series of secondary microbleeds in your skull, all not helped by the fact that you fell and slammed your patrician face into a console, did superficial damage to your cranium, and gave yourself severe concussion. You have been in an induced coma for the last few days while I dug around inside you and did my best to repair the damage. That's the simple part."
"The storm."
He clamped his eyes shut for a moment. Some of the aches were now becoming sharp pains.
"The storm, as we came out of the warp. The wrecks."
He felt his still numb muscles try to jerk him upright.
Gast, what happened to...
Void Mistress Gast is stable, but it will be some time before she is recovered enough for duties.
He stopped trying to move, and found that he had just enough movement to give a nod.
You have performed your duties excellently. I need to return to the bridge. I will ensure that you are rewarded.
But it's you that is the real question, Your Grace. You see, my craft is my life and soul, just as it was my father's and his mother's and so on, back Terra knows how far. I take it seriously.
Under the circumstances, I would find it difficult to believe anything else.
I do not allow myself to fail in my duty of care, you understand.
She had folded her hands over each other and was perfectly still. Only her mouth moved.
The indentures and writ that your sister imposed on my employment only enhance that duty. So understand me, Duke von Castellan, when I say my inducing temporary paralysis below your neck is for your good and my obligation to your well-being, rather than any order you may give me.
He stilled his mind, thoughts suddenly sharp. What was this woman? He thought of the rivals and enemies he had made in the decades of plying the void. He thought of the spite of alien lords and human queens. He thought of all the things and people he had seen serving Covenant, and wondered which of them had sent this creature to infiltrate his ship. He tried to move his fingers, to feel if the digital weapons he normally wore as rings were still there.
"Who sent you?"
he croaked, plying for any time he could get. Iaso flinched and shook her head.
You think I mean you harm? Did you not listen? I will do everything to keep you alive and healthy. But you are about to ask me to let you get up and leave this chamber, and I can't do that.
Cleander frowned, puzzled. If she was an assassin, she could have killed him already. If she wanted information, this was a strange way of extracting it.
My sister will demand that you let me leave.
Not if it will kill you, and not if you don't try to leave.
Why would trying to leave kill me?
Her mouth moved in what might have been a sad smile.
Simple questions, but I have a feeling all the answers are complicated.
She shook her head as though trying to clear it.
And the questions are what I woke you to ask, and the answers, well, they are yours to give.
Something in what she had said stopped the whir of thoughts. A chill spread slowly through him. He closed his eyes for a second, nodding to himself as understanding slid into place.
So many choices, he thought.
So many things done to run the edge of time for just a little longer.
You said that you went digging around in me.
Iaso nodded.
Yes, and the answer to your earlier questions are that I don't know what happened with the storm, nor exactly what caused your reaction.
She paused for a second, and he looked up at her.
But I have an idea it might be something to do with the alien technology wrapped around your central nervous system.
Severita watched as the servitors uncoupled a set of the cryocoolant tubes from the side of the casket holding Enagirid. Gas fumed the air in the small chamber for a second. One of the servitors limped to a gauge bolted to the wall behind the casket and tapped it with a finger, the gesture oddly stiff.
"Temperature rising,"
it droned, and limped back to its fellow next to the banks of hissing machinery at the side of the chamber.
"Are you sure you must be here for this?"
Mylasa's thought voice spoke inside Severita's head. The Psyker pivoted slightly, her robes and the toes of her withered feet brushing the floor lightly. A worm of cold light earthed through the gap between her and the floor.
"Genuinely, I know that I make you uncomfortable, and what I'm going to do..." "I stay,"
Severita replied, without looking away from the cryo casket.
some of the frost had started to melt on the glass view slit. She could see Enna's closed eyes inside.
"Very well," sent Mylasa, and turned back to the thawing casket. "But I don't think you're going to find this pleasant to be around."
Severita felt static dance up her arm. Worms of green charge began to dance on the decking. Mylasa suddenly seemed slightly indistinct, as though Severita was looking at her through a fine sheet of falling water. A halo of cold light was building around the Psyker's head. Severita braced herself. A jagged cord of light speared out of Mylasa and poured into the casket. In the second before she forced it out of her head, Severita thought she saw an image of a bird with bright green plumage flash across her thoughts and plunge down into a dark sea under a silver moon. Viola waited for the inner door of the infirmary airlock to open. Gas billowed from the ceiling. It felt cold and smelled of chemicals. For a second, surrounded by the fog, she let the exhaustion creep onto her face. She winced, rubbing her palms across her eyes. She wore a fresh uniform, a blue velvet officer's coat over a cream silk waistcoat, but the freshness and composure was an act of will. They were hanging in the void, blind to what was happening on the surface. She had her orders from Covenant to hold in place, and that is what she was doing, but as the storms closed in, real and etheric, it seemed like sitting and waiting for disaster to come to them. Actually, that was exactly what they were doing, and they were doing it deliberately. Something dark was rising, and they had come to meet it. The chem fog cleared. As the inner airlock door opened, Viola had her features recomposed into a picture of perfect control.
"Mistress Viola," said Iaso.
The Medicae Primus was waiting just inside the chamber. Viola's eyes went to the frame that her brother lay on. His eyes were closed, and a crisp white sheet covered him to his neck. Servo skulls hovered close to him, and a host of tubes and cables led from beneath the sheet to steel and glass machines that hissed and bobbled, like old men drowning in their own phlegm. He was still, though, chest barely moving.
"Has he regained consciousness?" asked Viola.
"You gave orders that you were to be informed if he had," said Iaso crisply.
Viola nodded, still looking at her brother.
"He never wanted it, you know," she said, and immediately wondered why.
"But that did not stop him taking it," said Iaso.
Viola shot her a hard look.
"My apologies, Lady Viola. It was an inappropriate observation."
Viola shook her head.
"But an accurate one. You were not with us then, of course, but when we were riding high, I wondered if he knew how to stop."
"A family trait, perhaps."
Viola shot the Medicae another look.
"My apologies again, but I can't unsee what I see. I don't know what the savants of your clan did to you or the exact pressures of your position, but I can see that you are suffering from acute mental fatigue and that the cocktail of stimulants in your blood is doing a good job of stopping you falling over. But that is a delicate balance to hold."
"You know, the first Xenos race he made contact with nearly killed him. He barely got away alive, and the prophets barely covered the losses. That was how he lost his eye, refused to have it replaced. But I've never seen him more alive. He had found something, and from then there was no way back, not for him. There were other ways to reverse our fortunes, many other ways. But from then the stakes just went up and up. In the end, when we started to lose, the only thing he was going to do was risk what was left on the longest odds he could find. It was freedom, I think, the only freedom he ever really had, the freedom to throw the dice and wait for them to fall."
She gave a snort of humorless laughter.
"I know that sounds strange. How can someone with so many choices and so much wealth not be free? But chains are real if they are all you can see."
She blinked, shook herself, realizing that she had said more than she intended.
"If I may say, my lady, realizing that it may overstep boundaries of familiarity, I wonder why you would follow him and help him on such a path.
Viola did not answer, but looked back at where her brother lay.
Will he recover?
Iaso turned her head slowly to look at Cleander, and then back to Viola. Her face was unreadable, as if she had been asked the time.
It is possible. Retrace your steps.
There were hands on Enna's head, on the back of her head, pushing her down, holding her down. The water was in her mouth, in her lungs.
Air! Please! Air!
And the air was streaming into her in silent gasps that were the beginning of drowning. Her head pulled, and the surface of the water exploded to a flat black mirror. Time was flowing backwards. A mirror face looked up at her. She looked down at it, and the mask of rags dropped over her head.
Revelation!
Came the hiss of voices around her, like a promise.
Retrace your steps. This way,
said Idris, as the door closed. Keep close. The corridor sucked her back down towards the dark of her sleep. The sounds of their feet on the grey marble floor were gunshots in the quiet. The candles lining the walls were dark and unlit. Idris was in front of her. Layers of black silk swirled around her. Pearl-tipped pins held the piled curls of her hair above her head.
I have been looking for you for a very long time, said Idris.
At the end of the corridor behind them, a candle in the open cell door snuffed out. Darkness embraced them. She folded down onto a bed in her small cell and slid back to the point between sleep and waking. Idris was standing above her, looking down. She had a candle in her hand.
Revelation, said Idris softly. Wake. Retrace your steps.
The door closed.
Why?
She called out. The man turned and walked to the door. His red cloak brushed the floor.
For everyone, he said.
For who?
It is best, he said.
His eyes met hers.
I don't understand, she said. Why am I here, my lord?
There were flecks of grey in his beard, she noticed. He looked behind him, at the cell door, where a figure in pale robes stood, its face veiled.
I am sorry, he said.
Between your servant and harm.
Aesir crouched in the space between the bases of the statues. Looking out, she could see just the dark, flat and black at the end of the narrow space she had crawled through. Everything was quiet, the echoing quiet that she did not like. But that meant that she would be able to hear the footsteps of anyone coming close. No one had come past her hiding place since she had doused the torch, lighting the passage beyond, and wriggled into the bolt hole. The monastery was filled with places like this, places that were as quiet and still as the pilgrim holes were bustling and loud. She had found others like them the few times when Grandfather had come in from the drift and fallen asleep in a shrine nook. She had gone looking into the quiet places then, and found that there were more of them than people thought. Passages filled with dust and darkness, chambers where statues looked down from behind cobweb veils, stairwells behind doors whose hinges could barely move for rust. She had wondered why the pilgrims did not come to those places. They would be better than the creaking refuse hovels that were the drift. If they took places like the Palace of Pillars, then why not these smaller pockets of nothing? After a while of padding through the shadows, she had realized why. They didn't know they were there. Now, squeezed into the dark between two statues, she hoped that no one knew that this place was there. She heard a sound like a boot on stone. Close. She held her breath. Had they followed her up the long spiral of stairs? Had they found the door that led to this chamber? They had seen her. She knew they had. They had seen her. as she ran from the Palace of Pillars. There had been eyes that had seen her, voices that had called out. Witch! She had run and run, and found a space in the quiet dark, and prayed to the God Emperor just like she had been taught. Witch! And now she was hearing footsteps, clear now, and coming closer. Witch! The breath was burning in her lungs. The steps stopped just at the end of the space she had squeezed into. She could hear breathing, heavy and wheezing. There was a smell, too, like iron or meat before it was cooked, and something whispering and black was coiling up out of her thoughts. She thought of what she had opened her eyes to in the Palace of Pillars, scorched, torn, tattered, and the heavy, sticky drip-drip that was the only sound in the vast space. Her lungs were filling with pain. The old prayer went around and around her thoughts faster and faster as the time went on and on.
God Emperor, who protects all, hear this prayer and stand between your servant and harm.
A sound of feet shifting on the stone, turning.
God Emperor, who protects all, hear this prayer and stand between your servant and harm.
A grunt of breath, so close that she imagined she could feel it.
God Emperor, who protects all, hear this prayer and stand between your servant and harm.
A last grunt of resignation, and then the sound of feet on stone was going away. When there was just silence, Aesir gasped in gulps of air. Only after several minutes did she stop, and then the tears came, falling silently in the dark, as the only prayer she remembered faded from her mind. Chapter 9. Snow was spiraling through the open side door of the gunship as it banked around the monastery spires. The whole frame was pitching and yawing. The wind was a gale. Joseph could see the wing lights of the other craft dancing as they fought the wind.
Sir, we are coming up on the target.
The pilot's voice was loud over the vox. It was the only way to hear anyone over the sound of the engines and the wind.
Atmospheric conditions are deteriorating. If we set down, then we won't be able to get airborne again.
Hover, drop and pull away, said Joseph, without pausing. Hold steady for fire support or extraction.
Mission command was his as Covenant's proxy. He had never worked directly with arbitrator units in this way, but command was like an old robe for him, so familiar that it just settled onto his shoulders without a crease.
Confirmed, said the pilot.
Joseph switched the vox to broadcast through the squadron.
All units, stand by, he said. Mission parameter is to find out what has happened. Hostility levels unknown, but presume that there is something that will try to kill us.
Confirmed, said Galt, from back in the crew compartment.
Orsino had sent the cold-eyed proctor with Joseph, and he fancied he could feel the man's malevolence in the clipped reply.
Going dark, said the pilot.
The wing lights on all three gunships went out. The gunner in the door beside Joseph swung the barrels of his rotor cannon around. They began to spin. The man's helmet was a mass of vision and targeting enhancers. In the crew compartment behind him, the arbitrators released their harnesses. Joseph slipped his right hand through the worn leather loop on the haft of his hammer. He raised the Aquila icon hanging around his neck with his left hand and kissed the cold brass.
You are of the priesthood, said a clear voice in his headset.
He glanced around and met the glowing red gaze of Sister Superior Agata. The battle sister was fully armed, sword sheathed at her back, a bolter in her hands, and her face hidden by a full helm.
I was, he shouted back.
But you talk like a soldier.
That I am and was, sister. The blessed Emperor has seen fit to call me to many different duties.
To serve the Inquisitor?
The gunship banked hard. Spires, domes, and towers whipped past. They were dropping fast, snow a blurred wall all around them. He could see the lights glimmering through leaded windows only meters away.
Target zone in sight, said the pilot.
Joseph grinned, gripping the grab rail beside the door as G-Force slammed through the gunship.
Yes, and do things like this.
The stone walls of the monastery fell away, and the pilgrim drift opened beneath them. Fire glowed through the blizzard. Shacks and piled structures were blazing. Roads threaded through the orange glow in jagged lines. The wind was whipping tongues of flame from rooftop to rooftop. Here and there were patches of unburned buildings, gathering coverings of snow.
The last location of the Shrine Guard units was half a mile along the main road from the gate, said Agata.
Sir, the fire is masking heat signatures, said the gunship pilot. There could be hundreds of people down there, or none at all. Only one way to find out. Take us in.
The gunships turned, spiraling down, the wind yanking them like kites jerked on strings.
If the Shrine Guard were ambushed, whoever did that could be waiting for us, said Agata.
Then we will know they are there for certain.
You don't strike me as a reckless soul, Preacher.
And you don't strike me as someone who counts the odds.
The ground was coming up fast. The heat of the fires touched Joseph's face, even through the cold wind. The gunner's hands were steady on the rotor cannon, fingers on triggers.
Ready to drop in three,
said the pilot, flattening out the gunship's flight in a roar of thrusters. The gunship was level for a second, then dropped. An open stretch of road lay between two rows of burning buildings.
Two.
The gunship's thrusters shrieked as they caught its descent and slammed it stationary 2 meters off the ground.
One.
Joseph shoved himself out of the open door and hit the ground. Agata dropped beside him. The gunship began to rise and pull away down the road as the arbitrators were still jumping from the open hatches. They hit the ground and dropped into firing crouches, bolters and combat shotguns trained on the buildings. Fire climbed the piled shacks. The snow underfoot was slush. Joseph could feel the sweat already pouring off him under his robes and thermal body glove. The gunships rose into the blizzard above them, howling into the night. Joseph moved forwards. The other two squads had been dropped 100 meters on either side of them on the road. The buildings and flame glow hid the monastery and stained the sky.
Contact! Shouted Gold. 50 meters, right arc, single figure closing, status unclear.
Joseph turned. A figure was walking towards them from the shadow of a building that was still only partially ablaze.
Halt, or you will be executed,
called an arbitrator, voice amplified above the wind. Joseph could see that the figure was limping.
Halt,
called Gold again.
Hold fire,
called Joseph. He was moving forwards as the figure stumbled and fell. He reached the figure as it tried to rise. It was a woman, thick-set and wearing the remains of padded armor sewn with bronze panels. Her left arm was gone at the elbow and left half of her face charred and clotted with black blood.
No, no, don't move,
said Joseph, kneeling down beside her. This close, he could hear the woman's breath, sawing and bubbling. The arbitrators had moved with him, forming a ring around them, guns pointed out into the flame-touched night. Joseph saw the woman's lips move and bent closer.
That's one of the Shrine Guard, said Agata from behind him.
Where are the others?
Snapped Gold.
Quiet, said Joseph.
The woman was shaking her head. A bubble of pink foam formed on her lips.
Be calm, said Joseph. What happened here?
Red,
hissed the woman. She began to shake.
No survivors. The drift. Pilgrims.
She was gasping now, panting as she fought for breath.
They all...
A mass of red foamed at her lips. She began to convulse. Her lips moved again. Joseph leaned closer. Blood bubbles exploded on his cheeks.
What did she say? Asked Gold.
Joseph felt the blood drain from his face. He pushed himself up, the surge of adrenaline seeming to drag on him.
The woman gave a shudder and went still.
She said,
hearing the drum of his heart louder than the words,
they are all pilgrims of hate now.
Behind them, a fork of lightning punched up into the blizzard from the ground and tore a hovering gunship from the sky above them. There was commotion around the gate of bells as the sound of an explosion rattled the doors.
Get back!
Growled one of the shrine guard, shoving a cluster of pilgrims filling the passage who had just made it through the doors before they closed. One of them turned slowly, rag-wrapped head rising. The torchlight caught a glint of metal. Of sharp metal. The shrine guard saw and was shouting as the knife point punched up under the chin of his helm. The pilgrims were shrugging off their snow-covered cloaks. The woman who had stabbed the first guard stepped back, shedding rotting cloth like her skin. There was a hooked blade in her hand and jagged scars across her bald scalp. A high ringing filled the air. The pilgrims were all red now, all wrapped in tatters. And the guards by the door were turning, shock on their faces and shouts on their lips. The woman in red looked like she was grinning, showing all her teeth. But it was not a smile. It was a cut that ran from edge to edge of the woman's face. And the shouts of surprise were all screams now. Iacto could hear the noise as he approached the doors to the House of Concordance, raised voices and the crash of heavy objects striking the floor. Claudia was close behind him with two novitiates dragging carts of parchment rolls and leather-bound tomes. Two figures in black armor stepped into their path. His eyes met the wide mouths of leveled guns.
"Identify yourselves. You have 5 seconds to comply," said one of the figures. Its voice was a machine-modulated growl echoing from its helm.
He shrank back. He felt his guts lurch.
"It's true," he thought.
This had to mean it was true. The Inquisition had come on the eve of night. He had not believed the news when Claudia had brought in the summons.
"I am Abbot Iacto," he said. "I am head of the Sage Order of the Faithful. I was..."
A red lacquered servo skull buzzed in from behind the armored figures and gripped his face with metal calipers. He jerked back, but the skull gripped tighter.
"Be still,"
growled one of the armored figures. Iacto went still. The skull pulled itself to within a centimeter of his face. A pulse of red light flicked out from the skull's sockets and bored into Iacto's eyes. He bit back a yelp. The skull clattered and beeped, then released his head. The second skull must have done the same to Claudia, because she was blinking and had an expression that he knew meant she was only just holding her temper.
"You are identified and logged," said one of the armored figures.
They stepped to the side. The doors to the House of Concordance opened.
"You may enter."
Iacto nodded and turned to make sure the two novitiates followed with the records. He noticed half a dozen servo skulls with articulated steel legs scuttle off the stacks of scrolls and books like spiders.
"Not them," said one of the guards. "Only you and your second may pass."
Iacto looked around, a protest forming in his mouth. He met the mirrored visor of the nearest figure, and the words faded.
"Come,"
he said to Claudia, and gripped the handles of one of the carts. Noise greeted them as they stepped through the doors. More figures in black armor were ripping the ancient pews from the floor and clearing a wide space of bare floor around the rostrum at the center of the domed chamber. A tech priest in gray robes and a hunched machine frame was manipulating dials and levers on one of a series of blocky machines. Thick cables snaked across the floor and through open access grates. A smell of static and burning plastic touched his nose. A wave of heat washed over Iacto as the doors closed and locked behind him. More armored figures stood at the room's edge, slab-framed guns held across their chests. A dark-skinned man in a long trench coat watched Iacto and Claudia from a seat in the remaining pews.
Next to him sat a decrepit-looking man wearing green robes over a frame so thin he could have passed for a mummified corpse. A cluster of figures he knew stood at the centre of the cleared floor. The bishop stooped beneath her panoply of penitent chains. Next to her stood Archdeacon Saul, red-faced and sweating. The guards on the door had clearly denied his attendants entrance, because the archdeacon was carrying his huge ceremonial bone and iron mace in his own hands. As Iacto moved forwards, he noticed Saul shift his weight and blink as sweat ran down his face. Opposite them stood a woman in black armour, her wrinkled face set beneath a towering headdress of silver and brass, an eagle-topped staff in her hands. She was saying something, and authority and control radiated from her expression, even though Iacto could not hear the words.
"The Inquisitor," he thought, as the group noticed him and turned. "Abbot Iacto," said Bishop Zelita. "He is head of the most ancient order of the faithful, who keep the records and histories of this holy place. He has the plans you have asked for."
Iacto was about to bow to the woman in the gilded headdress when she gave a bark of laughter.
"Not me," she said,
and stepped back. Iacto saw that there was a fourth member of the group. The man was young, with dark hair swept up into a topknot above a sharp face. The mark of the Inquisition gleamed on his red cuirass. The hilt of a sword projected from above his shoulders. Iacto tried not to stare. He had never seen a member of the Inquisition before, and part of him was somehow disappointed. A soul who wielded the power of the Emperor himself was just a man. He began to kneel, mouth opening to give formal greeting.
"Why do we need plans?" blurted Saul.
Iacto looked up, surprised. Saul's hands were gripping and ungripping the mace, sweat rolling down his face. The Inquisitor had turned to look at the Archdeacon, and there was something in the way that neither gaze nor expression altered that made Iacto's skin prickle with cold in the heat. Iacto saw Saul swallow. He suddenly wanted to shout at the man, to be quiet, to keep whatever fear was driving him to speak behind his teeth.
"What do records matter?"
Saul was shaking.
"We must pull out! The servants of darkness have come with the night! We must—"
"Control yourself, sir," said the woman in the headdress.
Now that he was closer, he could see the symbols of judgment, law, and authority on her staff, headdress, and panoply.
"Adeptus Arbites," he realized. "A judge."
He swallowed and found his throat dry. Even without an inquisitor, this aged woman had the power to enforce imperial law without limit or oversight. Saul's jaw was still working, his eyes darting between hard faces. Iacto coughed and stepped forwards, pulling the first scroll from the cart next to him.
"Honoured lords and most holy servants of our emperor," said Iacto into the uneasy quiet. "This is the most recent plan of the complex. It was conducted 111 years ago, but all but a few of the pertinent details are still accurate."
He unrolled it between his hands and looked up. Bishop Zelita shot him a look that he fancied held a note of relief at his intervention. Saul was blinking away sweat. His eyes were glazed, his pupils wide.
"I brought other plans of the structure that can help create a more detailed picture."
He chanced to look up at the judge and the Inquisitor.
"Where do your eminences require them?"
The judge was frowning, her gaze moving between Saul and Zelita. The Inquisitor was looking directly at Iacto.
"And the other records?" said the Inquisitor.
Iacto felt the smile he had been wearing behind his expression fade.
"Here, my lord,"
he said, and gestured to Claudia to bring forward the other cart of ledgers and codices.
"There are more, but these cover the areas you—"
"Glavius IV row,
said the Inquisitor, looking to the hunched tech priest in grey as the gun on his shoulder rotated to fix on Iacto.
"I await your command, lord. but please be aware.
The tech priest slotted a thick cable into the side of a block of machinery. Lights lit on its side, and a cone of static-filled green light blinked into the air.
The previous tasks that I am working to complete remain in a state between beginning and completion.
Aid the abbot with compiling the information out of the records.
As you will it, said the tech priest.
Iacto bowed, then looked up. A question came to his lips, and despite all the decades that had taught him that silence was survival and curiosity dangerous, he heard his voice sound in the still air.
My Lord Inquisitor, we have brought records of the passing of days going back 5 centuries. What is it that you are looking for in the records?
He wished he had not asked as soon as he had spoken. The Inquisitor took a step forward and lifted a leather-bound almanac from those heaped in the cart. He opened it. Dust puffed into the air. The Inquisitor's eyes moved down the page and then up to Iacto. The abbot flinched back from the hard fire in that gaze.
For the handmarks of the divine, he said.
The burning wreckage of the gunship had not even touched the ground when a second lightning bolt struck the other gunship and blew it apart. Agata's visor blinked black, but the flashes exploded in her mind.
Down!
She shouted. A blazing wing hit the building just in front of them. Fire and dust burst into the air. A blast wave ripped out. A chunk of rubble hit an arbitrator in the base of the back as he turned to run and mashed his armor into his torso. Agata staggered, servos whirring in her armor as it fought to keep her standing. In her mind, the litany of the Endurance lit like a flame.
Emperor, you are my strength.
Flame punched up into the blizzard as the remains of the second gunship hit the ground.
As you are eternal, so I am unbreakable.
Red flame and smoke curled into an anvil head above.
As you endure, so shall I bear the blows of the unclean.
The arbitrators were picking themselves up, but there were figures in the buildings around them now, figures who would pull themselves out of the shadows. Agata's skin was prickling, and even through her helm she could taste ozone and sulphur. She saw the preacher, Joseph, trying to stand up from where he had fallen. He had his hammer in his hand, but there was blood on his face, and he fell back as he tried to get his feet under him. Agata fired. The first bolt tore the closing figures apart. She ran, firing with each stride, the bolter kicking in her grip. She shifted target as she moved, each movement requiring no thought, like a prayer recited until the words were written on the soul. Flesh and bone tore apart, blood salted the snow. She was beside the preacher, her gauntlet under his arm.
Move!
She roared, yanking his bulk up, servos shrieking, muscles tearing. He almost collapsed back. There were more figures coming from the burning dark. Agata fired one-handed, aiming low. The figures were shrieking, curses hissing from mouths that no longer had tongues. The bolt shells punched into the rubbled ground at their feet and exploded. Airbursts of shrapnel and stone splinters tore their legs apart, tumbling them to the ground, still. The round counter in her helm display flashed red. More figures came out of the swirl of snow and smoke. She clamped the bolter to her thigh and drew the sword from her back in a single movement. The blade was heavy, designed to be wielded with 2 hands.
"The master of mankind watches over me," she called.
The blade lit with a whip-crack of lightning. Joseph was blinking, head shaking as though trying to clear it of sleep, weight swaying as Agata supported him. A few arbitrators were standing. The ragged figures charged.
As he is my shield!
A wasted figure loomed out of the dark, nails hammered into its frostbitten torso, face a mask of blood and torn skin, its arms dragging a block of black metal on a heavy chain over its head to smash down into Agata.
So I am the death of his enemies!
And the sword cut through the falling snow.
Lord Covenant!
Glavius Forro's shout was loud enough to make Iacto flinch, books tumbling out of his hands.
The tech priest straightened from one of the blocks of machinery that had been dragged into the chamber. Iacto looked up, realizing only now just how tall the tech priest was. Inquisitor Covenant was looking around from where he was talking with Zelita. Archdeacon Saul had been dismissed and was halfway to the door.
Lord Covenant, I should inform you that I have completed interface with the basic machine communication methods used in this complex place of worship ruin.
The tech priest paused, and its hooded head twitched like a man trying to shake water from his ear.
It is low grade, but the signals are clear. They say that there are false pilgrims within the walls. They say that there is slaughter.
Where? Said the judge, striding forwards.
I said,
stammered Saul from where he had stopped.
I said, this is it. It's the end. We must get out. We...
I have not created an integrated visualization of the complex, but the signals list the following names, location designators. Gate of Bells, Western Cloister Edge, the Bridge of Penance, Eastern Cloister Edge, the 20th Catacomb Level.
Iacto had reached back and pulled a rolled map from the cart and spread it across the floor. It was inaccurate, made more by reverence than a belief in accuracy, but it showed the large areas of the monastery well enough. He jabbed at areas of the map. The others in the room were gathering around him.
Here, here, and here. Blessing of saints, they are everywhere.
His heart was a hammer beat in his chest. What was happening? For the first time in a long time, he felt small, a cog turning in a machine rather than the hand which turned it.
We must go,
yammered Saul, his voice high and breathless.
You have a ship. You can take us. We can...
Get control of yourself,
snapped Bishop Zelita.
The reports are increasing in intensity and frequency, said Glavius Forro, his voice as level and calm as if he had been reading off power fluctuation data. The phrase, Red Pilgrims, is becoming a notable feature of all communications, potentially reaching persistent self-replicating meme status.
Visual reports, said the judge.
Minimal, Judge Orsino, said Glavius Forro.
It must have been them, said Iacto.
The charnel cistern in the Western Drift filled his mind.
In the Western Drift, it must have been them.
Your God is dead.
What are you talking about, Abbot? Said Zelita.
There was an atrocity in the Western Drift. There were remains, butchered and mutilated.
What is this?
Hissed the bishop, coming closer, her face taut with shock and rage. Across the room, he could see Saul looking at him, blinking, frozen.
Oh, you foolish creature, thought a part of Iacto, clear and still in the whirl of his thoughts.
You did not tell her.
The shrine guard knew,
he said, his voice cold and calm.
My lord, we have lost contact with Joseph and the arbitrators sent to the Western Pilgrim Enclave.
What is happening?
Roared Zelita, rounding on Saul.
What have you been keeping from me?
Nothing,
he blustered. His face was red, his lips pale.
There was word of a sect forming in the pilgrims, followers of a prophet. It happens all the time, but...
All units on deployment readiness,
shouted Judge Orsino.
We should contain and lock down as much of the complex as we can, Covenant.
Contain?
Spluttered Saul.
We need to get out. We need to...
Archdeacon Saul, said Covenant, you will place all of your shrine guards under Judge Orsino's direct command.
You have not seen, have not heard,
growled Saul.
100 of my guards went into the Western Drift.
Where are they now?
They are bones and ashes, as we shall be too.
Iacto was standing, the map still in his hand. His eyes were fixed on Saul. He could read the terror curdling into panic and rage in the man's eyes. Covenant and Orsino seemed very still.
He was aware that the arbitrators at the edge of the room had shifted, gunstocks tucking into shoulders.
He has lost control, thought Iacto. He is not seeing. He is not thinking. He is like an animal caught in a river, thrashing as it drowns.
It's the end, you see,
growled Saul, and his hands were gripping the ceremonial mace now, fingers flexing. He took a step towards Zelita.
You can feel it. You know it, you stupid, jumped-up peasant. Hunger, fire, and blood. The lights in the sky. The ship's leaving.
He took another step, the mace raised in his hands. His eyes were wide, and what sanity remained behind them had vanished. Zelita did not move. Iacto could see anger and shock on her face.
Night has come, gasped Saul, and the only thing to do is to run before it drags us all down.
He swung the mace up. His chest exploded. The sound of the gunshot filled the space, shockingly loud, echoing on and on. Saul's corpse blasted backwards and fell in a bloody tangle. Iacto stared, unable to move. His ears were ringing, his limbs frozen. Jar Jorsino lowered her aim. A thread of smoke was curling from the barrel of the silver and gold-chased bolt pistol in her hand. The exo-bracing on her arm clicked as a set of recoil locks released with a whir of springs and cogs. Iacto realized he had not even seen her draw the weapon.
Sentence of execution reached and carried out.
God, Emperor!
Gasped Joseph. The pain washed through him, jolting up nerves with every movement. His feet were moving, crunching and sliding over snow-covered rubble. Bubbles of color expanded and burst in his sight. He could see flames and the silhouettes of ruined buildings. Another jolt, another spear of pain up his back.
God, Emperor, and all his tearful saints,
he snarled.
You would add blasphemy to your troubles, priest, said a female voice from just next to his head.
He blinked, twisting to try to see where the voice had come from.
No, just keep walking. There will be more coming.
He recognized the voice then. Agata. She was supporting him under his left shoulder, one power-armored arm gripping him across the back, the other holding a bolt pistol. She had removed her helm. Snow was catching in her gray hair. Her face was a mask of effort.
I can walk, he said. Let me walk.
No, she said, through gritted teeth. No, you can't. You tried a half a kilometer back and did not make two steps.
She glanced around, the movement precise. Her eyes moved between the shadows and the still falling snow.
If we stop, they have a better chance of gathering in force. We took two waves, but a third would be martyrdom.
He took a breath and gritted his teeth. Something, or several things, felt like they were broken and torn inside the right of his torso. It was sharp and clear, though, what his old comrades in the naval armsmen squadrons called alive for now pain. He could see now. There were a handful of figures in black arbitrator armor moving with him, guns tracking the flame-lit lean-tos and scrap buildings around them. At a glance, he could tell that most of them were injured. The moments before he had blacked out flicked back into his mind. He saw the witch lightning punch the gunships from the sky, saw the wreckage fall. He heard the dying woman in the bronze armor gasp her last warning.
Red pilgrims.
Witches, he gasped. They are inside the walls. We have to get back to the monastery.
Not if we want to live, she said.
And every sororitas that I have met always took those kinds of odds as a challenge.
This is not a matter of faith. It is a matter of duty, she hissed.
You are not as direct as the others of the sisterhood I have known.
Oh, I am, she said. I am just old, and have been alone long enough to become weak to the indulgence of petty humor.
She winced as they jolted over a fold in the ground. Joseph could hear the woman's pain in the quick breath she took.
You are hurt, he
said.
Not as badly as you, and we need to keep moving.
Joseph looked up and then turned his head to look behind him. The lights of the monastery's windows glinted like weak stars through the falling snow.
We are going away from the monastery, he said.
I can see why someone so observant might be useful to the Inquisition, she said, gritting her teeth. Most of those they left are strung out close to the monastery wall, but there are other things with them. They will expect us to try to get back, so we go in the other direction.
And then what?
We trust in the God Emperor to gift us with another idea, she said.
You!
Gasped Iacto, his eyes on Saul's mangled corpse and the blood flowing out across the tiled floor. Iacto could not look away from the archdeacon's blood-spattered face. The man's eyes were still open, staring up at the domed ceiling without seeing.
Justice has been done, said Judge Orsino, her voice cold iron. For endangerment of the body Imperium through cowardice and manifest incompetence, there are sentences within my power that are less kind.
Zelita was staring at the corpse too.
This is the House of Concordance, a place of unity and peace in a holy place. This
is a place of peace no longer, said Covenant. This is now a place of war.
He turned.
Every gate and door to the areas under attack is to be sealed immediately.
He glanced at Orsino.
Send squads to hold the key points, main passages and access points.
There are countless ways into every part of this place, said Iacto.
Covenant ignored him.
My lord, said Zelita, the abbot is correct. These incidents are happening on the edge of the cloister districts, but the ways in and out go from down in the earth to bridges between towers. You can't shut or close them all.
Glavius Forro bent and picked the plan of the monastery Iacto had used off the floor.
The statement made by the priest, monastic secondary tier leader, seems to be highly likely. The number of variables and resources at our disposal do not make for a pleasing correspondence.
But there are places that people would have to come through if they came up or through other areas, said Iacto. They are what you need to hold.
Covenant did not answer for a second.
Show me.
Covenant nodded at Glavius Forro. Iacto turned to obey, only then releasing the breath he had been holding.
Then return to the records, Abbot.
Iacto paused, then bowed his head to hide his surprise. As he looked down, his eye caught the dead gaze of Saul, staring up and seeing nothing, while his life drained red onto the ground.
Chapter 10. The world was black, edge to edge, and so far out that there was no depth to it. Enna turned her head, and then realized that she did not have a head to turn. She did not have a body either, just a viewpoint into black infinity. She blinked, and suddenly she could feel her limbs and skin.
Let's start here, shall we?
Enna's gaze snapped around. A woman sat on a white ivory chair, what seemed like a pace away. The blank dark behind and beneath her made her seem like a portrait painted onto black glass. Her hair was copper red and fell in a long, smooth spill across her left shoulder and down the side of a dress of green silk and black brocade. She smiled, her slim face barely creasing with the expression. There was something familiar about her, but Enna could not remember. She could not remember anything. She knew her name. She knew who she was. But the rest was just a...
Yes, said the woman in green. I had to tie off your memories. Most of them, anyway. Makes life simpler.
She yawned as though fighting off a sudden wave of tiredness.
And simplicity is very much what we need in your case. Who are you?
Asked Enna. The woman in green laughed dryly.
Funny, she said,
without humour. But then, how are you to know? And of course the question is not who I am, but who you are, Enna Girid.
I?
Difficult for you to answer that at the moment, of course, said the woman in green. She rubbed her fingers over her eyes and blinked as though to try and shake off another wave of fatigue.
I have done as much digging as I can. Killing you might have let me open up a couple of other portions of your consciousness, but only maybe, and as good an idea as death might be, my hands are tied.
The woman in green's eyes flicked to a point just over Enna's shoulder. For the first time since the woman had appeared, Enna was aware of a presence just behind her. She turned her head.
No,
said the woman in green, and the word snapped Enna's gaze back around as though yanked by a chain. The woman gave a cold smile.
Look at me, Enna. Just at me.
Enna nodded, though she was not sure why. For an instant, when she had turned her head, she had caught sight of a figure in black robes in the corner of her eye, its face hidden in the shadow of its caul.
The thing is, Enna, that you are not as simple as you appear, and no, I don't mean to say you are stupid. Your memories, your mind, your life barely belong to you. Believe me that I know what I'm talking about when I say that a lot of work has been done to you. Layers of false belief, grafted memories, cutouts, recollection oubliettes. Your mind is a maze full of secrets and traps, and the chances are that I have barely scratched the surface. Impressive, really. Loathsome as well, but impressive. The fact that I didn't spot it when I probed your mind, well, that alone says something, doesn't it? I have no idea what you're talking about.
The woman gave a tired nod, and then looked away.
You are a lie, Enna Girid, she said. You are a lie given form and flesh. Someone took you, and willingly or not, re-sculpted your mind. They gave you a name. They gave you a past, and for everything they gave, they took more away. You are not who you believe yourself to be. You are not who we thought you were.
The woman gave a cold chuckle.
Though you are not alone in that.
The woman in green stood and suddenly was right in front of Enna's face.
There are three of you, she said. One is called Enna Girid, and she believed that she was the loyal servant of an inquisitor called Idris. She is loyal, tough, and a bit impulsive. She is the you that is hearing this, that is thinking that it can't be true.
The blackness behind the woman changed. Figures pulled into shape, like statues rising from tar. Enna could see stone sarcophagi and a ring of figures in cloth masks, and her own face frozen in mid-scream before it was forced down beneath the surface.
Then there is the you that was made by the renewed on Iago, the you that is just a membrane of coldness, a killer, a tool to greater ends.
Enna was about to shrug when the memories poured into her. She saw the conclave and the renewed coming out of the dust cloud with crystal blades. She saw Idris die. She saw Covenant and his cadre of followers. She saw Iago and the shrine of the dead emperor in the warren beneath its surface. She saw Tolikto, their quarry, long dead on his skeleton throne. She saw Idris standing in the flicker of her psychically trapped memory. And she saw herself looking down at a coin.
And then, last of all, the woman nodded over Enna's shoulder. There is the you that the other two hide.
Enna felt herself turning even as she realized that she didn't want to, that she wanted to do anything but see what had been standing there all this time. A figure in black stood in front of her, head bowed, draped in black robes that were a cascade of black sand.
Your third self, said the woman in green. What you are saying means nothing to me, said Enna, still staring at the grains of black sand flow in the folds of robes. I don't even know who you are.
No, you don't. But I thought it might be better if you knew the truth before I gave you back some of the context.
She paused, then shivered, the green silk rustling. I am not kind, but I try to avoid cruelty. Lightning crackled through the air, splitting the dark like a knife sawed through cloth. A window formed in mid-air, edged by white sparks. She saw a chamber filled with vibrating machines and clouds of frost and steam. A woman in a red body glove and Hessian shift knelt in front of a metal casket, sword clasped in her hands. Nearer to Enna's viewpoint floated a figure with withered limbs, its head ringed by bulbous chrome machinery.
My Lassa, said Enna,
suddenly knowing who the woman in green must be. Then she looked at the metal casket and saw her own face beyond the frosted view slit. She began to shake. She could feel liquid pouring into her lungs, fire filling her thoughts, the cold of a silver coin in her hand. Her voice was shaking with terror.
My Lassa, help me!
No, said my Lassa. As I said, I am sorry, but I am here for the truth, and whatever that requires will be done.
But I am not a heretic. I have served the Emperor. I am Enna Girid. I am...
My Lassa shook her head. Come and see for yourself, she said.
Go,
whispered Ninkara, and loosed the hawk from her wrist. The bird beat its wings and glided away into the dark of the girder space. In her mind, the hawk's augmented vision showed her a world of grey edges and black voids. The second hawk shifted on her shoulder, its claws digging into the mesh plates woven into her body glove. Around her, the dark of the deep hull extended, soft and black and silent. In her ear, the voice of the von Castellan datafile whispered like a ghost.
The von Castellan dynasty originates from the planet of Xarxes Plethys, Valrio subsector, Gastshrine sector, Segmentum Tempestus. The brigantine Dionysia is currently the only vessel under the dynasty's control.
The cavern that they had landed the gunship in had been well sealed, but she had found her way out eventually. A small pressure hatch into a maintenance duct, and then a long crawl dragging her vacuum casket behind her. She did not think she had tripped any security measures, or if she had, she had yet to see a response. Even a small ship like this was still vast, and you could not guard every inch of it. The seneschal of the von Castellans was clever, though, and subtle, at least according to the files, so it was best to assume nothing. Once she had got out of the sealed section, gravity and air had returned. She had stripped her void suit and packed it into the vacuum casket. She had hung a chameleoline woven cloak over her mesh body glove and strapped her collapsed sword to the small of her back. Then she had strapped the pistols, data gauntlet, and pouches of small equipment in place. Last had been an inframonocle, which turned half her sight into monochrome green dark sight, or the coloured smudges of heat vision as she required. Her hawks woken, she had stashed the vacuum caskets in a crawl space. A tiny microtransmitter would lead her back to it when the time came. If the time came. She had yet to work out a proper method of attack, let alone an escape plan for when it was done. The first step, though, was to find out where she was and then build steps to the target. Standing in the dark, watching the landscape of machines and pipes glide past her hawk's eyes, she wondered how long it had been since a living human had trod these decks. Years? Decades? More?
At the height of its prosperity, the dynasty controlled a fleet of 6 vessels.
The hawk slid through a gap in a mass of pipes. A black gulf opened beneath. It wheeled, its wings catching an updraft. A shaft soared upwards towards a distant light. She willed the bird to settle on a projecting strut.
Much of the success of the dynasty rests not in the hands of the titular bearer of the warrant of trade, Cleander von Castellan.
Ninkara paused for a second, the beginning of her next steps forming in her thoughts. She did not have the ability or time to tease information from her starship's data systems. No. She would have to rely on older, simpler, more human means of finding her prey.
But in the surviving younger sister, Viola von Castellan, known to many as the Mistress of Threads, lies much of the dynasty's remaining power.
she would begin at the core of things, at the center of the web.
"How do you do it?" asked Baal,
from where he waited by her study door. Viola paused in scrolling through the data feed and looked up.
"Keep going, I mean. How do you keep processing and holding on to it all?"
"By not being interrupted," she said, and looked back at the glowing flow of numbers and glyphs. Static and distortion filled the cascade. The distortions to Vox and communication systems had been getting worse and worse since the storm had cut them off from the surface of Dominicus Prime, as though its winds were billowing inside the machines themselves. She blinked, and the flow had changed again. To almost anybody, it would look like a screed of random symbols, some not even part of any recognizable imperial dialect. It was the trade cant of her dynasty, and to her it was as familiar as speech. At least, it normally was. For a second, when she had looked back, it had seemed like nothing, like static on a blown pict screen. She put the data slate down on the desk. "How did you get so good with guns?" she asked. Baal looked around, his surprise at the question clear on his face. She shrugged.
"Well?"
"I didn't have much choice," he said. "In the Stack archipelagos, you don't get past walking without knowing how to fight. Sometimes you don't even get that chance. But I was better than most, useful even, and that had value. So when the Burn Famine came, my family sold me to the Death Brokers. They did the rest, day in, day out, hour after hour, drill and fire, and drill, and then testing, and more. That's the way they do it, until the guns are more real to you than your empty hands."
Viola nodded.
"And it worked?"
Baal grinned and raised his hands, fingers open.
"These feel as awkward as hell right now."
She smiled and rubbed her eyes with her palms.
"When I was 6, I was given to the family savants. I was the 3rd born, and that was what happened to children fortunate enough to be 2 steps away from inheritance. Christina was the heir, Cleander the spare. He was destined for the Navy Officer Corps at Baca. They already knew this, and what my role would be. I just didn't get told until I was 6. That is when the brain is developed enough to be trained, but still growing. So that's when they started. Cognitive conditioning, day in, day out."
She felt her mouth twitch into a cold smile, but the sound that came with it was a snort.
"It started with rhymes, children's rhymes, or that's what they seemed like anyway. Tiny, tiny spider climbed up the waterspout. On and on in particular rhythms and tones. Sometimes they would change just a word, or the timing of a breath in speaking it. On and on. Des, sire. Nova, sire. Oct, sire. Then there were the games. Patterns and numbers, and the rules never exactly the same twice. Every minute of every day was like that. Even sleep was timed to the second. When I got to play, it was always a game they chose, and the game was always a lesson. Things started to happen. One day, I walked down the corridors that held the ashes of our ancestors, all of them, going back to before the age of apostasy. Each sepulchre listed the span of their life and the deeds they had done in service of our bloodline. It was a long walk, and I did not think I did more than glance at each of the plaques. But afterwards, one of my tutors started one of the rhymes, and suddenly it was just pouring out of me. Every name, every date. Zartha von Castellan, 672.M38 to 792.M38. Instituted the Treaty of Nevres with the Hierarchs of Salpon. Castio von Castellan, 710.M38 to 801.M38. Commanded Battle Group Jove at the Battle of Draco Gulf. Even now, it's still there, all of it, written in the fabric of my nerves. She realized that she had placed her hands on the top of the desk, flat, palms down, like a child waiting for a class. She glanced up at Baal, but the bodyguard was just looking at her and frowning. She shrugged.
They did not start on the surgery or the alchemistry until I was 12, I think. That was when things really started to become serious. The nursery rhymes and games stopped, but the thought patterns they hid continued. The demands and the methods became more intense. Have you heard what a data deluge is? To her surprise, Baal nodded.
Some of the high scribes on Serapho used to do that, open themselves up to a load of information until they almost dropped dead.
Until all of the mind's capacity to remember and process is exceeded is more accurate. She let out a breath and leaned her head back. The neon ghosts of trade cant symbols rolled over the blackness inside her eyelids.
It is like being drowned. They give you just long enough to come up for air, and then they put you back under, again and again.
She opened her eyes, looking at the document and data slate-strewn desk, but seeing the sunlit tower tutor cells and the hollow induction machines sitting on the white floors. And all the time I had to do mental gymnastics, simultaneous pattern and logic analysis, memory sieving and scraping, and more information poured in. They beamed most of it into my eyes just below the rate of cognitive comprehension. It wasn't until I was of age that they took my eye. She brought her finger to her cheek and pulled down the eyelid so that he could see the wet chrome wire bundles in the socket.
Near flawless, and lets me see the dynasty's lifeblood of ones and zeros flow, grow, or run out, all without closing my eyes.
Most of the savants used mind interface sockets to access data, but that would have been too uncouth for one of the bloodline, and anyway, I didn't need it. In the end, it turned out that I was quite the star student. Father and mother were pleased. She was staring at the desk again, at the auto quills and scrolls.
Tiny, tiny spider.
And you? Said Baal.
Hmm?
She blinked and looked up, and blinked again. Suddenly she felt very tired.
Oh, I was... I don't know. I was what I needed to be. The keystone of a dynasty.
Isn't that the Duke von Castellan?
She laughed then.
You have met my brother, haven't you?
He nodded.
And now, he asked, what are you now?
I,
she said, and stood.
I am tired.
You have actually reached the point where you're going to want to sleep. I never thought I would see the day. You must be telling the truth.
And you are too familiar and ask too many questions for a household life ward.
He shrugged.
I've always thought that most people like to answer the questions that they don't often get asked.
A philosopher and a killer.
No wonder you caught Kynortus's eye.
You are just his type.
The grin again.
I will leave you to rest, mistress, and am pleased that you didn't have me whipped for asking.
He turned towards the door, then stopped his hand, close to the release.
You know, when I was learning gunplay, at first I wished every day that someone would come and take me away. Take the gun out of my hand and make me something else. Somebody else.
He paused, frowned, mouth half open to speak.
And here you are, she said.
And here I am, he smiled. But you know, now I can't think of who else I would rather be.
He keyed the door release and stepped out into the corridor beyond.
Good night, mistress.
Good night,
she said, as the door shut and sealed after him.
And find the gates to hope closed. Aesir folded back into the darkness of a statue niche as the shrine guard passed. Candlelight shone from the cheeks of their faceplates. She had seen them once before when they had come into the drift to find a man who had stolen an icon from one of the shrines inside the cloisters. They had broken his left hand and left him screaming. Ever since then, she had thought of their masks as shouting, not crying. She had decided to go back to the drift 2 days ago,
but it had taken her this long to work her way through the cloister levels to the Gate of Bells. 2 days of silence and small movements, of taking water from where it leaked down walls, and eking out a piece of bread she had taken from a plate left in a deserted refectory. She held her breath, waiting for them to pass, listening to the clink of their iron truncheons against the bronze squares sewn into their jackets. They were everywhere now, walking the passages and standing guard on doors. They were looking for her, because of what had happened in the Palace of Pillars, because of that silent scream that had reduced the flesh of her grandfather's killers to dripping blood and tatters. She knew it without needing to be certain.
Witch.
The word breathed through the monastery in a thousand whispers. She had heard it spoken by a pair of penitents as they walked within feet of her. There were hunters in the complex, and people had been burned in the drifts. Every eye was looking for her, and every hand was an enemy. It would be no safer out in the drifts, but that was not why she had come to the Gate of Bells. She wanted to go home. She leaned slightly out of the statue's shadow and glanced in the direction of the Gate of Bells. It was open. She could see the sky beyond the arch and the light of a midday sun. Home. Her grandfather was gone, but if she could just get home, it would be all right. One of the shrine guards twitched their head towards her as they passed. Aesir flinched back, but the guard was slowing, turning aside from the column and reaching for the rod of iron hanging from its belt. She felt herself tremble as the helm's black eye-holes reached into the shadow that held her.
"You! Back into ranks!" called a voice from amongst the shrine guards, and the guard stopped. "Yes, you!"
And the guard stepped away and joined the march to the open door. Aesir waited until the last of them had passed before looking out again. She edged forward, out of the shadow. A bell tolled above the gate, its sound harsh and loud in the corridor. She wondered why they had sounded one of the bells. They never did that.
"By order of the Archdeacon, the doors are to be sealed," called one of the guards. "Let it be done."
The keykeepers bowed their heads and began to drag the doors shut. Aesir was moving forwards before she could stop herself, running towards the narrowing slit of daylight. She must have cried out because one of the guards turned, and there were no shadows to hide her now.
"Halt!"
came a shout. She kept running. The door was almost closed, the daylight drawing a thinning line across the stone floor. And now the other guards were turning.
"Please!" she screamed in her head. "Please!"
The doors shut with a dull boom.
"No!"
she shouted, still not seeing the wall of shrine guards. Then a whip cracked out, and pain exploded in her legs, and she was on the floor, gasping, and the masked guards were all around, reaching for her, and she could hear the word that breathed through their thoughts.
"Witch! Witch! Witch!"
She tried to push herself up, but a boot lashed into her skull, and the world juddered out of time. The guards were moving, but it was like a book she had once seen, where you flick the pages and a man ran from a hunting beast across the top of the sheets of paper. She did not stop to think what was happening, but pushed herself up and began to run, shoving and ducking past the guards and sprinting away from the doors. Above her, the candles burned like suns in their iron stands. And then she was not running down a passage under the light of candles. She was running across a desert. Clouds of rust-red dust billowed around her, and laughter chuckled with the sound of wind singing in a dried skull's teeth. She looked behind. 4 silent shadows loped through the dust swirl behind her.
"Weakness! Weakness!" they hissed in a voice of running sand. "You cannot last. Run you down. Tear you from your false throne. Rot your soul to ash. Eat your screams. Give you to the fire's hunger."
And she knew they were right, that it was only a matter of time and exhaustion. And the edge of a stone caught her toe. She stumbled. Her hand slammed into the stone of the passageway. She gasped, but did not look back at the masked guards or the closed doors. She needed to keep running. She was squeezing past a statue plinth and into the crawl space beyond as the world slammed back into motion. The screams followed her as she scrambled down into the dark. Chapter 11. A tide of figures in rags flooded into the cloister of the brothers and sisters of the Emperor's Word. They found most of the order in the refectory at tables laid for the Feast of Last Light. The pure and true order of the key died at prayer, their pleas falling silent as their blood soaked the blue tiles of their chapels. The sisters of the Solar Light fought, pulling rusted swords from the sepulchres of their long-dead founders. They killed many of the ragged throng who poured into their halls, but